and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. Welcome to the New York State Tobacco Cessation Conference Call. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions following the presentation. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Ms. Ann Wendland. Ms. Wendland, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Rachel. Good afternoon. This is Ann Wendland, Cessation Programs Manager for the New York State Department of Health Tobacco Control Program. And on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers and New York State Smokers Quit Line, I'd like to welcome you to today's call, Smoking and Mental Illness, Break the Connection, What Every Prescriber Needs to Know. If you have not downloaded the slides for today's presentation, I've pulled up a screenshot of the New York State Smokers Quit Line's quit site. On the left-hand side of their homepage, you'll see the news feed section. And then directly below that, there's the announcement of today's call, and there's a link where you can click to bring up today's presentation. On the same page under resources, you will also find a list of the New York State Smokers, the New York State Tobacco Control Program's cessation centers. I circled the contact on the screen, and that will bring you to a two-page document. And this is hard to read, but just showing you what the document consists of, a two-page document that lists all of the cessation center staff and the counties that they work within. Cessation center staff are available to assist your organization with developing and implementing tobacco dependence treatment policies and clinical protocols, and you're welcome to contact them for assistance with tobacco dependence treatment. I wanted to point out a couple of other logistics. On the bottom left-hand corner, you should see an option to make the presentation a full screen. You can click on that and we'll take up your whole screen. You can hit escape and it will return back to this view if you choose to do that. You will not disrupt anybody else by turning to full screen. Secondly, if you want to post questions while Dr. Miller or Dr. Williams is speaking today, you may pose the questions to Jill Williams, MD, and she's logged on just as herself. There's two locations. There's one with Dr. Miller and Dr. Williams, and there's one with just Dr. Williams. If you post questions to Dr. Williams in the chat section at the bottom right-hand side, then they will address some questions in between. If you choose to just speak your questions, we will have a question and answer period at the end after both Drs. Miller and Williams have spoken. So as I've stated, our featured speakers today are Dr. Gregory Miller. He's the Medical Director for the Division of Adult Services at the New York State Office of Mental Health, and Dr. Jill Williams, who is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. On today's call, our speakers will discuss the reasons for tobacco use among people with serious mental illness by explaining the neurobiology of nicotine dependence and examining psychiatric medications that are impacted by smoking. Also, they will discuss how psychiatrists and psychiatric prescribers can assist their clients with tobacco dependence. Before we start, I have some other housekeeping items. We are pleased to offer CME, CRCE, and OASES continuing education credits to the listeners of today's presentation. To fulfill the requirement for continuing education, we are required to disclose the following. Dr. Miller has no real or perceived vested interest in relate to this presentation, nor does he have any relationships with pharmaceutical companies and or other corporations whose products or services are related to pertinent therapeutic areas. Dr. Williams has no real or perceived vested interest that relate to this presentation. Her presentation is free from commercial bias or financial interests. Dr. Williams has received grant support from the National Institute of Drug Abuse and the National Institute of Mental Health and Pfizer. She is an advisory board member at Pfizer. To obtain continuing education credits, follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms, which are posted on the Quitline's website. Please remember, applications for credit will not be accepted after December 6th. This is 1 week from today, so please be sure to submit your applications as soon as possible to receive credit. Now it's my pleasure to turn the call over to Greg Miller. Dr. Miller? And I'm going to turn this pointer over to you. Oops, 1 second. Okay, you should have...
I think I'm all set. Thank you, Ann. Good morning, everybody. This is Greg Miller. And as Dooley introduced us both, I want to say that I am very happy to be able to present this collaborative webinar with Tobacco Control and the Cessation Centers. And as many of you know out there, we have really at OMH been trying to drive and disseminate approaches to break the connection with smoking and serious mental illness for some time. And our partners over at Tobacco Control and in the Cessation Centers have really identified this as a major strategy as well. So this is one of many collaborative efforts that you'll probably be seeing coming out here, and we really hope that this is going to be something that helps us to move forward in a positive way with this population. And I'll tell you why we need to do that. As soon as Ann, the arrow up and down is not working.
Click your mouse on the screen.
I'm sorry?
Click your mouse on the screen.
Okay.
And now it should act.
There you go. Okay. Thank you. Despite all the preparation, I still missed out on it. So we've already gone over the objectives. What we really want you to get from this today is an understanding of what some of the issues that are salient to the population of people with serious mental illness in particular, and the importance that we as behavioral health providers and as behavioral health prescribers look at ways to integrate tobacco dependence treatment. We really think that that is going to be the way that moves forward and really addresses this problem that seems to be a more difficult problem to address for people that are living with serious mental illness. Why should we become involved? I'm sorry, before I move on into the slides, let me just say that Dr. Williams, who's going to be here, is going to present the second half of the slides. The way we're thinking about this, as Ann said, is as you have questions that come up at the intermission between my presentation and Dr. Williams, we'll look at some of those questions. She's here with me now, and we will address some of those questions for a few minutes before we move on to talk more specifically about the psychopharmacology. Dr. Williams is working in New York State with us right now for the next several months, and we're hopeful that she's going to have some ability, and that we're going to be able to use her expertise as probably one of the most or the foremost researcher and academic psychiatrist in tobacco dependence treatment for people with serious mental illness in the country. So we're looking forward to using her to help our initiatives as well. So why should we take this seriously and become involved as behavioral health providers? First of all, it saves lives. If people with serious mental illness who are able to quit smoking are going to have healthier and longer lives, it saves healthcare dollars, obviously. It improves productivity. It is something that is very likely to improve functionality, as we'll discuss a little bit more in this part of the presentation. The next bullet here is very important for us to realize, because I run into a lot of prescribers who say that tobacco dependence is really a problem for primary care. Nicotine dependence is a DSM-4, soon to be DSM-5 disorder. We are the experts in treating addiction disorders. We really believe in integrated care, mental health, and substance dependence treatment together. It's a strong argument for why this is our disorder and something that we should provide the expertise, particularly for those people that are living with serious mental illness. They're co-occurring disorders, as I said, and that expertise, the psychosocial treatments and expertise, is part of our professional skill sets. It's very consistent with our approach toward recovery and wellness. Tobacco dependence treatment is a wellness-related goal that is worthy of really working with our clients around. Reimbursement for treatment is improving. In New York State at the Office of Mental Health, we are really trying a great deal to find ways to incentivize and drive forward integrated tobacco dependence treatment. Traditionally, and I have to say that I've been part of this myself, the approach of smoking and people with serious mental illness has been to have a very permissive attitude. I can remember times in my own profession and my own practice with serious mental illness that I really felt like we were being almost punitive to patients to think about asking them to quit smoking when they were living through so much pain in other areas. I don't think that was so much because I didn't see my patients as being able to quit. It was more because I didn't really believe myself or have a lot of hope myself that they were going to be able to quit. I think that the turning point for me personally was when I realized that I wasn't giving my patients credit enough to not believe that they were as capable of quitting as anybody else would be. And I think that was a very important moment when I realized that my permissiveness about smoking was really that I was kind of saying patients who have serious mental illness aren't quite as capable to quit smoking as other people are. I think that's probably a big reason that we've been slow on the draw with getting people with serious mental illness to think about the health benefits of quitting smoking. We do know from the evidence base that there are benefits from quitting smoking for people that have serious substance abuse and serious mental illness. There are studies that really do imply that relapse is far more common with different types of substance abuse when smoking is not addressed as a co-occurring disorder along with other substance use. So when cocaine, alcohol are treated and smoking is not addressed, it's more likely in several studies have shown this, that there will be a relapse on the primary substance that has been treated as well. Who owns this problem? So our mental health population represents a very wide spectrum of people. Smoking has a high prevalence across the continuum of people that have in their lifetime had a diagnosis of a mental health disorder. Only 22% of smokers have don't show some history of psychiatric illness, either currently or in the past. So the vast majority, about three-fourths or more, of people who are smokers have had at some point in their life a psychiatric illness or currently have. So if you divide that out, around 23%, 22 to 23% have no psychiatric illness. Within the last month, about 42%, and ever about 35%. But that's not the full story, because that includes everybody with any psychiatric illness, anxiety disorder, mild depression, dysthymia, all the way up to severe mental illness. And I believe that, and I think the evidence does imply, that people who in the spectrum of psychiatric diagnoses have more serious diagnosis, such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, people who have more function loss and more chronicity in their mental illness, tend to be less likely to have quit smoking or to have successfully quit smoking over the course of their lives. Or, to put it another way, the prevalence of smoking amongst people who are diagnosed with a serious mental illness is much higher than in the general population. So there's a case to be made, particularly for people who have serious mental illness, many of whom see their primary health provider as being their behavioral health provider. So we give them their health care in many circumstances, more so than any other provider, that the case can be made that population in particular, a population of people who have not done well at quitting smoking, for whom the prevalence of smoking is still very high. The case can be made that we need to really own the problem ourselves as behavioral health providers, and to be the front line or the primary drivers in moving toward helping them to stop smoking. If you look at the incidence of smoking or the prevalence of smoking in the general population since the time that the information has been collected, around 1965, you'll see that there has been a lot of success in professional and public health approaches to quit smoking. In fact, if you look at 1965, the general population, that's the solid blue line in the middle, the top line is male and the dotted line on the bottom is females. You'll see that the general population, it was around 45% in 65 who smoked in the general population. Going on up to 2005 in the general population, where it was down to around 20%, 22%. This is an additional slide that shows the prevalence going forward from 2005. It's a little bit more complicated slide, but if you look at that solid blue line, again, that's the overall population, you'll see that while it's kind of stagnated around 20%, it's still trending downward. And in New York State, there's been even more pronounced downward trend. I believe that in New York State, the latest data are showing that the incidence is somewhere down in the upper teens, 16 to 18%, if I remember correctly. So the prevalence of smoking in the general population is trending down. I think it's safe to say that in the last few years, it may reflect a little bit less funding and drive on public health tobacco control. But in the last few years, there's been sort of a plateau. And one reason for that plateau may be that that people who can be reached with the current public health approaches to smoking have tended to be reached, and that we're increasingly left with a population of smokers that are not easily quitting smoking. It doesn't mean they don't want to. It means it may be that there is a core population we're increasingly left with for whom it's harder for them to quit smoking, and the efforts are going to need to be more intensive. I would argue that people with serious mental illness and substance use disorders really are probably a strong constituent of that core population of people that have a difficult time quitting smoking. And indeed, if you were to look at the prevalence of smoking over the course of 1965 to now, you would probably see almost no decrease at all. It would probably be off the charts in both of the charts that I've just shown you, and it would probably go somewhere around 50 to 60% prevalence across the board, depending on how you define serious mental illness. If you looked at the population of people that are diagnosed with schizophrenia, you'd probably find 60% or above, and you'd probably find that even today, that is the prevalence of smoking in that population. So you'd sort of see a flat line all the way from 1965 across, implying that increasingly the people who smoke are made up of this population of people with serious mental illness who smoke a lot of cigarettes, and there's even some evidence now that marketing efforts are being focused on these populations because they are the ones that are smoking cigarettes. Almost half the cigarettes that are smoked these days are smoked by people that have a serious mental illness and or serious substance abuse disorder. Now, if you look at quit attempts in the total population, I think it's still fair to say that most of the people who quit smoking, even today, pretty much quit on their own. They may get, with increased focus on primary care to address smoking, they may get assessment at their primary care setting. They may get some counseling or assistance or referral. They may get prescriptions for NRT. But by and large, the majority of people who quit smoking decide to quit put down their cigarettes, quit smoking, maybe take them a time or two, or go into a 7-Eleven and buy some NRT and use it themselves. They may seek some counsel from their primary care, or they may not. I think if you were to look at the population of people with serious mental illness who quit smoking, you'd probably find that the majority of people with serious mental illness who quit smoking quit the same way that everybody else does. They probably just quit on their own. But they probably don't have as much of an easy time of it. It may be more difficult for them to. And they may feel, it may be that fewer people do with serious mental illness because of the efforts and the need for assistance being greater in that population of people. So if you look at people with, say, depression and anxiety, milder forms of mental illness, and compare it to schizophrenia as a marker of an illness that that is a serious mental illness, it does seem like people with depression are less likely to try to quit smoking and anxiety, but their quit rates, while they may not be as successful as the general population or the non-depressed, non-anxious population, but they are closer to successful quit attempts than if you look at the population of people with schizophrenia. People with schizophrenia are less likely to make a quit attempt on their own, even though they want to quit smoking. There's a lot of evidence that there's a desire to quit smoking, but it may be that their sense of the potential to succeed at it reflects our own as providers for many years, that they don't really know how easy it's going to be for them. That may be because it's a more significant chemical dependence. It may be because of the complication of trying to quit smoking in the midst of having a serious mental illness. But there's less of a likelihood that someone with schizophrenia will make an attempt on their own. And when they do, using currently available methods of assistance, it's less likely that they will be as successful as people in the general population. The motivation is there, nonetheless. We need to figure out ways to help our patients to kick this problem that's killing them. Now, this slide is to show you that there is an association with smoking and suicide attempts and suicide ideation, and an association with daily smoking and suicide thoughts or attempts, even when controlled and adjusted for prior depression and substance use disorders, or even prior attempts. So suicidality or major symptomatology that we are worried about, obviously, with serious mental illness, has an association with chronic smoking. And I don't really need to show you this. We all know that there is a vastly increased incidence of chronic medical illness for people with serious mental illness. We all know about the data that's come out from the National Association of Mental Health Program Directors in 2006 that shows that on average, people with serious mental illness are likely to die up to 20 to 25 years earlier than their non-seriously mentally ill counterparts, and the vast majority of cause for this early death in this population is not due to complications from their psychiatric illness, but rather more likely to be due to complications from chronic medical illness such as diabetes, heart disease, obesity, pulmonary lung disease, and smoking is the largest preventable cause of these chronic medical diseases that our patients have. So if we could, in a major way, change the incidence of smoking in the population of people with serious mental illness, we could eliminate a huge component of the cause for early death in our patients. So this slide is really just to sort of make the case that perhaps there's a difference in how difficult it is for people with serious mental illness versus people with non-serious mental illness to quit smoking. So the case, again, that I'm making is that I believe we should own responsibility and drive tobacco cessation for everyone that we treat. But I particularly believe for those of us that are treating serious mental illness and Office of Mental Health licensed programs, that we probably should think about being the primary tobacco dependence treaters for our population of patients with serious mental illness. That's not a huge portion of the population of people with mental illness overall. It's about 2.5 to 3%, about 6% of the total population, about 2.5 to 3% suffer from bipolar disorder, another 2% from schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorders. And then there are other disorders that we consider serious mental illness due to their chronicity and their impact on functioning. But it is a significant portion of the population of people that we treat in our public psychiatry settings, in our licensed clinics, in our PROS programs, in our ACT teams. We have a much higher proportion of population of people with serious mental illness. And I'm sort of making the case that we should begin to think of ourselves as the primary tobacco dependence treaters for that population of people, because we're more likely to be involved in intensive treatment with those patients, and those patients are more likely to need integrated tobacco dependence treatment into their behavioral health treatment in order to have a successful quit attempt. Now let's think about traditional tobacco control techniques. Our current public health model for tobacco control focuses on workplace outreach. It might miss a lot of the serious mental illness population due to the fact that a lot of people that are suffering from serious mental illness may not be integrated into employee assistance programs. In general, the allocation of resources traditionally to public health and preventive approaches to smoking may not necessarily encroach or engage people that live with serious mental illness. As an example, how many people with serious mental illness are really worried about whether or not they can smoke in a restaurant in New York City? How many people with serious mental illness are really worried about the sidewalk being the only place they can smoke? I would argue it's more likely that somebody who lives with serious mental illness does a lot of their smoking on the sidewalk. So it may be that approaches that help the general population to smoke less don't really wrap around this population in the same way or as effectively. It's clear that people with serious mental illness are motivated to quit, but they may be less successful with conventional treatment. We've made that point already. And so therefore, they are probably going to need a stronger focus and a more intensive focus. One thing that has been demonstrated about schizophrenia and smoking, in addition to its high prevalence, people with schizophrenia tend to smoke more cigarettes, and they tend to get more tobacco out of the nicotine out of the cigarettes they smoke. So if you do topography studies have been done on patients with schizophrenia, and they have been shown to show that not only do schizophrenics tend to smoke the cigarette all the way down to the bottom of the cigarette, but that with each, they take more puffs off of each cigarette, and each puff that they do take, they extract more nicotine and also more of the chemicals that are in the tobacco as they smoke cigarettes. So they're really experts at extracting all the nasty stuff out of the cigarettes that's impairing their health. By the way, let me just put in a little plug. Dr. Williams just showed me a note that said, so far we haven't had any questions. So if there are people out there, I know you are probably having some thoughts or questions as you listen to this. type in some questions to Dr. Williams, and we will focus on those questions in the intermission between my presentation and hers. And we're getting ready to make that transition now, because we're going to move in to a more specific and focused discussion on the pharmacologic aspects of nicotine and the tobacco medications, because one of the issues we really want to make clear for this presentation is how easy it is, in the first place, to prescribe tobacco medications, in particular for we psychiatrists and we psychiatric prescribers who prescribe some of the most complex and dangerous medications that exist in the entire pharmacopoeia. It really should be a piece of cake for us to think about prescribing NRT and tobacco cessation medication. So one of the goals that we have is to help everybody to feel more comfortable prescribing medications. So let's begin to talk about the pharmacology of tobacco. We all know that the active agent of tobacco is nicotine. Now, why might it be that people with serious mental illness have a stronger addiction to cigarettes or a stronger dependence on cigarettes? Let's not call it addiction necessarily, even though it is an addiction, but the chemical dependence component of the addiction may be stronger because, in fact, there may be beneficial effects of nicotine on the illness. Nicotine is a cognitive enhancer. There have been studies that have shown that audio-evoked potential, which is a marker of schizophrenia in about 50% of the population, tends to normalize in patients who with nicotine. It may actually have effects on symptoms of illness, but nicotine also may, because it's a cognitive enhancer, tend to mitigate some of the side effects from antipsychotic medications that people with serious mental illness take. So there may be a reason coming from the illness itself that makes nicotine chemically harder to stop using for somebody that has a serious mental illness. It's important when you think about nicotine that there be a recognition that it's not the nicotine that's causing the harmful effects. As I talk to psychiatrists and prescribers across the state, I often hear people wondering about the dangers of nicotine. Nicotine in and of itself is probably a very benign medication or a very benign pharmaceutical agent compared to others. It's everything else that's in the cigarette that kills them. So it's not the nicotine that's killing the patients. It's the way the nicotine is getting into them that's killing them through tobacco, and in particular when the tobacco is smoked through the smoking. So there are thousands of compounds in smoke, over 60 of them being well-defined as carcinogens, and we also know the impact that tobacco smoking has on blood pressure and cardiac well-being as well. So it is an important beginning fact when you think about nicotine and the pharmacology of nicotine, that it's not the nicotine that's causing the danger. That's a little bit different than other substances. When you think of nicotine as being a substance of abuse, there are some differences. Nicotine in and of itself is not as dangerous when it's used, even in a high amount, as some other substances of abuse are. So cocaine and alcohol have serious deleterious effects, maybe that override those of nicotine. It's also that another difference about nicotine as an addictive agent or an agent of abuse or substance dependence is that nicotine in and of itself doesn't create an intoxication in a patient that makes them dysfunctional per se. It is not like someone who is addicted to alcohol or cocaine or opiates for whom their functionality is impaired by virtue of the substance itself. it's not an intoxicant of that nature. So it's a, you know, while nicotine is a substance that can create addiction and dependency, it is different from other addictions in some subtle ways, and it's important to remember those ways when you when you're treating it as an addiction and a co-occurring addiction. All right, so we're at the point now where we're going to move from my presentation into the presentation of Dr. Williams. There have been a couple of questions here, and Dr. Williams is going to take the first one, and we will scan some of these questions and discuss some of them before she moves into hers. So I would like to now introduce Dr. Jill Williams.
Thank you, Dr. Miller. Thank you for inviting me to participate in this conference, and certainly thank you to the cessation centers also and the Department of Tobacco Control. The first question says was about people with schizophrenia extracting more nicotine from cigarettes. The question was, has this really been studied? Is there evidence for this? And I actually have conducted several of those studies. As Dr. Miller mentioned, they're called topography studies. They use a small device called a topography machine, which actually captures all of the cigarette puffing patterns that a person would use. And we measure that behavior for about 24 hours. And we did a study, which we published in Smokers with Schizophrenia, which showed exactly what he reported, that they really do puff differently on cigarettes, taking more puffs per cigarette and actually extracting more nicotine per cigarette. So great question. We have some more questions as well.
Right. There's a question that came in that was asking about whether or not the slides will be made available. They will be made available. I will leave it to the sponsors to give you the details on that after the presentation. There is a question that I think is a very interesting question that I'll bring up now. We might want to bring it back to the forefront after Dr. Williams' presentation. But it is asking, is it appropriate to use nicotine replacement therapies in hospitalized patients who are forced to smoke less but have no interest in quitting at the present time? That's a good question, and it's a question that comes up often. My opinion, and we'll let Dr. Williams also opine on it as well, is that absolutely, I absolutely do believe that if what you are doing with someone on an inpatient unit is simply delivering nicotine to them in a different way besides the way that they've been using it, first and foremost to help them with withdrawal symptoms, because it clearly has been established that people who have serious mental illness who smoke have more agitated and even aggressive symptoms if they aren't treated with nicotine. So nicotine withdrawal should be treated on any smoker who is in hospitalized and not able to smoke. I believe there's a role to continue to use it because you're delivering nicotine to someone who is not yet ready to quit, and you have an opportunity to work with them while they are there to help them to move toward becoming smoke-free and to also experience nicotine being delivered to them in a way that is not through cigarettes. So my opinion is that there is a role for NRT in people who are not motivated to quit smoking while they're on an inpatient unit. I don't think that we take advantage of the opportunity of a smoke-free period of time to help them then move out of the inpatient unit with a commitment to try to quit. Dr. Williams, do you want to take it from there?
I completely agree with what Dr. Miller said. I also think it's useful to frame it in terms of detox. If you detox clients from other substances in this setting, it makes sense to detox also from this substance. And we probably in these settings are detoxing people who are also not motivated to stop their other substances, but it just becomes a part of what we do, and we value that in and of itself. So would clearly support that. The questions are rolling in. I see many of them now, which is very exciting. I don't know if you want us to take one more or if you want us to continue. Maybe we'll take one more and then we'll continue with the presentations, but it's good to see the enthusiasm. Several of the questions are about medications. I think we'll wait for those because I'm going to present a bit of information on medication. Is there anyone in particular you want to choose?
Let me see here.
There's one on marketing.
Okay. All right. There was a question here. That was a good one. Let's take this as the last one, and then we'll move on. It was mentioned that research suggests that marketing efforts are targeting at-risk populations, and the question is asking if I was referring to specifically to the to the mental health population or to the underserved in general. My understanding is that there is evidence that of both, that certainly the underserved population is being marketed to, but there's evidence that implies that specific marketing strategies toward seriously mental or toward people with mental illness is being developed. Now, I don't know the specifics of how that marketing is going forward. Dr. Williams, do you?
Well, there's certainly evidence if you look at tobacco ads, and you could even look at these if you wanted through the legacy documents which were made available to the public through the Master Settlement Agreement. But there's evidence certainly of using cigarettes to manipulate mood, and things like that that do really approach kind of a psychiatric audience. There's evidence of lots of donations from tobacco industry over the years to state hospitals providing cigarettes. So it's a bit of a gray area, but certainly I think that they've been willing and pushing that boundary towards recognizing this group of customers. And really, you know, they're not supposed to be targeting vulnerable populations, and so it's something we should be really vigilant of. Okay, so I'm going to continue now with our presentation and follow up where Dr. Miller left off. In emphasizing, again, the importance for treatment, it's important to recognize that this population of smokers is likely more dependent than other smokers in the general population, and increasingly studies are showing that this is the case. This is a small sample that we looked at of 100 smokers with serious mental illness, but it also makes the point that many of them are saying that they smoke immediately upon waking in the morning, and when smokers tell you that they wake up within the first 30 minutes of awakening in the morning, it's an indicator that they're moderately to severely nicotine dependent, and it's an estimate that they may need medication to be successful in quitting. In fact, if smokers smoke in the first 5 minutes of waking up in the morning, it's an indicator of severe nicotine dependence. And you can see it's rather striking that 50 out of 100 of these consumers that we asked this one question, in fact, told us they smoked in the first 5 minutes in the morning, indicating a severe level of nicotine dependence. So that really informs us about treatment and underscores the need for psychopharmacology. Luckily, we have lots of options in treatment for tobacco. There's several FDA-approved treatments, which I'll be speaking about today. If I don't mention one of something you may have heard of as a treatment, you're welcome to ask a question, but keep in mind that that probably indicates it's not an FDA-approved treatment or an evidence-based treatment. So the evidence-based treatments are listed on this slide in terms of medication. They include nicotine replacement medication, of which there's five kinds of nicotine replacement, and two non-nicotine treatments. The first of these is bupropion, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and is also known as Zyban or Wellbutrin. And lastly, varenicline or Chantix, the newest approved treatment. So I'll say a bit more about each of these medications. But it's important as professionals that we're really current and up to date with our information about nicotine replacement medication. I'm in New York, so I say, well, Duane Reed. How bad could this medication be if it's available in Duane Reed? Yet it's not uncommon for patients to say that their doctor, their psychiatrist, doesn't want to give them nicotine replacement because they feel it's too risky. Yet the government makes the medication over-the-counter and widely available to the public. So there's a disconnect there. And the truth is, as Dr. Miller indicated, nicotine is actually a very safe and effective treatment. That's why it's FDA approved, and that's why several of these treatments are over-the-counter. We have to remind ourselves nicotine is not a carcinogen. Nicotine is not the reason that people get COPD, lung disease, cancer, and heart attacks from smoking. Because nicotine is delivered to the body so efficiently from smoking, it's actually a challenge to give people enough nicotine from their nicotine replacement medication. And most of the guidelines nowadays are quite liberal in the recommendations for nicotine replacement. So, you know, there's not an exact dose necessarily. You can titrate to the dose that makes the patient comfortable. You can tell the patient use it all day long. People have been on nicotine medication in studies for up to 5 years with no evidence of long-term side effects. So there don't have to be any strict tapering or dosing schedules that you necessarily have to follow. Nicotine is very safe to combine with other forms of nicotine, so it's not uncommon nowadays for patients to be given a treatment regimen of, say, nicotine patch plus nicotine gum. And studies are showing that these combinations are more effective than monotherapy treatments. And nicotine is also safe in combination with treatments like bupropion, and that can be a nice treatment plan for some people as well. There's almost no patient that you could convince me would not be a candidate for nicotine replacement therapy, because if your patient's using cigarettes today, they're likely a candidate and would be better off with nicotine replacement medication. So those concepts are important and help really understand a lot about the safety and efficacy of nicotine replacement medication. Unfortunately, it's not really feasible to give nicotine as an oral medication. It's poorly absorbed through the GI system, and there's a lot of first-pass metabolism. So the reason that we have all these alternate forms of nicotine are to try and bypass that. So nicotine is going through the skin. And in what seems to be the oral forms of nicotine, actually the goal is not to get nicotine into the stomach, but nicotine gets absorbed through the lining of the cheek, and that's how it's going through the bloodstream. So again, these are in some ways not very efficient delivery mechanisms for putting nicotine into the bloodstream, and as you can imagine, we tend to underdose a lot of people using nicotine this way, and studies are showing, again, with combination modalities, we might do a better job of providing nicotine replacement and reducing withdrawal and relapse rates. Along the same lines, there's really not much evidence that nicotine itself causes cardiac disease. In fact, cardiologists are largely on board with this nowadays and provide nicotine replacement aggressively in the CCU and after heart attack and things like that, recognizing that the real threat to the patient with cardiac disease is not nicotine per se, but it's lack of oxygen and other toxins that come from cigarette smoking. So again, in clients that we typically see in the behavioral health setting who are using cigarettes, we really want to think of this in terms of harm reduction. This is substituting the patient's nicotine for a much safer delivery of nicotine and therefore not even introducing a new drug necessarily into the patient's regimen. There's often concern of what will happen when patients smoke and use nicotine replacement medication concurrently. I often joke it's kind of the spontaneous combustion idea. There's a lot of fear, which is not really grounded in science, about things that will happen to patients when they smoke on the patch, say. And again, studies are increasingly showing that really nothing much happens when patients smoke on the patch, that it's a relatively safe practice. And some evidence for that comes from a large study that was recently conducted in the UK, where they're a few steps ahead of us in providing systematic smoking cessation treatment to their population. They've recognized that despite access to free treatment in the UK, there tend to be subgroups of populations of smokers that never seem to be interested in quit smoking treatment. So they decided they would take a different approach, and they gave patients 6 to 18 months in different studies of access to nicotine replacement medication, recognizing that these were smokers who said that they didn't want to quit, just to see what would happen. And in fact, these were really interesting studies. 7% of these patients who said that they didn't want to quit smoking actually quit smoking from using nicotine replacement alone, which is an interesting aspect of the study. But more importantly, for this discussion, there was no evidence that in these many thousands of smokers who smoked and used nicotine replacement for 6 to 18 months, that there were really no adverse events. The only thing that happens when you smoke on the patch, really, is that there's an increased incidence of nausea, but nothing in terms of life-threatening effects. So we want to be much more liberal, I think, in using nicotine replacement, encouraging patients to use it even when they have slips, keeping people in treatment. Remember, the old model would often be the patch would be withdrawn when somebody smoked. And I get those calls from group homes and different places where people remove the patch because someone was seen smoking. And I want to encourage the team to keep working with the client, encourage them to come back to smoking cessation treatment, and to keep encourage the client to keep wearing the patch if the risk really is not great. And that, you know, it could be seen as really a punishment to the patient that he or she had treatment withdrawn because of relapse. That's certainly not consistent with how we do other substance abuse treatment. When people relapse, we're supposed to provide more treatment, not actually to withdraw treatment. So let me say a bit about the medications. This is obviously going to be a brief introduction to these medications on this webinar. But the good news about nicotine replacement is it's fairly straightforward in terms of using and dosing it. The five products that are available, which include the patch, the gum, the lozenge, the inhaler, and the nasal spray, are equal in terms of their overall effectiveness. So one product is not more efficacious than another, so you can really choose these products based on patient choice or side effects or availability. And again, because products like the gum and the lozenge are considered low delivery products, they don't deliver a lot of nicotine per piece. In general, we think of products like the gum and lozenge of giving a half to a cigarette's worth of nicotine per piece. You can imagine that if you're seeing clients who are heavy smokers who smoke 30 cigarettes a day, it would just technically be hard to use 30 or 40 pieces of gum a day to meet that need, and it can be a more efficient strategy, say, to wear the 21-milligram patch and give some baseline level of nicotine and then supplement throughout the day with one of the shorter-acting or low-dose nicotine. So the combination, adding immediate-acting products to the patch is a very commonly used strategy. Again, some things to know about the gum and lozenge is that they're being absorbed through the lining of the cheek. It's important that when people use the oral forms of nicotine replacement that they be told not to use them with acidic beverages, which includes most beverages like coffee, soda, and juice. That will interfere, the acidic pH will interfere with the absorption of nicotine. So that's an important aspect of psychoeducation and using those products correctly. The inhaler, technically is actually not an inhaler. It's really an oral puffer, so it seems like the person's inhaling it, but the nicotine doesn't actually reach the lung. So in many ways, it's similar to the gum and the lozenge in that the delivery is oral. The nasal spray actually gives the biggest and best dose of nicotine in terms of absorption through the lining of the nose. However, it's associated with the most side effects in terms of nasal irritation and sneezing, and so it tends to not be widely used. So clearly, nicotine treatments are effective. We know in many studies with tens of thousands of patients that they double the success rate of quitting compared to placebo treatment. We want to be using them more aggressively, maybe in combination. And certainly, there's a great need for patient education. So I don't think the expectation we would ever want that patient is just going to the pharmacy and using it. We want it to be part of the team discussion. And luckily in New York, there's great access to these medications so that patients should never have to pay out of pocket for them anyway. In terms of the non-nicotine treatments, bupropion is rather straightforward, so I'm not going to say a whole lot about it. You still wouldn't give it to patients who have history of seizure or eating disorder because of the risk of seizure. It's dosed in much the same way that it's used in depression and is highly effective in treating smoking, even in people with no history of depression. So its effect on smoking cessation is independent of its effect on, I forgot what I just said, depression and smoking. They're independent. Chantix is also a first-line treatment, and in fact, studies have shown that the efficacy of Chantix in helping people to stop smoking is actually greater. There's two or three studies now showing this, that varenicline is actually more effective as a monotherapy than any of the other monotherapies. So increasing evidence showing that this is probably the most effective treatment that we have for helping people to stop smoking. And certainly there has been concern about the black box warning and the risk for potential neuropsychiatric side effects, but I'll say some more about that. This slide is showing results from a recently published clinical trial that I participated in. It was sponsored by Pfizer, but was a multi-site trial of smokers with schizophrenia who were motivated to quit smoking, this was Chantix, varenicline versus a placebo in a 12-week a double-blind placebo-controlled trial, and you can see that Chantix was superior, varenicline was superior to placebo when you look at the point prevalence at 12 weeks after quitting, and in fact, studies of smokers with schizophrenia have been striking in that the placebo rate is much lower also than in the general population. So placebo treatments do not seem to work in smokers with schizophrenia at the same rate that they work in the general population, which I think says something about the high levels of addiction in this population. The other thing that's interesting about this study is if you look from week 4 to about week 10, the rate of people who are quitting smoking in terms of the point prevalence absence is actually increasing. So, you know, hang in there with people, I think, is the important message. More people had quit 4 or 5 weeks after the quit date than actually the first week. So maybe it needed some time to work. Maybe patients needed to practice until they kind of were quitting more successfully. It's not clear entirely what that means, but that's a little bit of an unusual pattern in terms of more people quitting as the trial went on. And I don't have a slide to show you, but you can reference the paper. Certainly the safety information from this study was quite good. In terms of low rate for adverse events. There's actually a lot of data that's now been published that supports the safety of varenicline. This was, again, an analysis that came out of the United Kingdom that looked at 80,000 smokers who had either received nicotine replacement, varenicline, or bupropion, and followed them over time to see what happened. And there was no evidence in this very large population-based sample that the smokers that got varenicline had more higher rates of depression or suicidal thoughts. So there were some of those, of course, as you would imagine, in a population of 80,000 people, but their rates were no different, whether or not people got nicotine replacement, varenicline, or bupropion. And I think that that's comforting and really underscores the safety of this treatment. Another important aspect of just treating tobacco dependence in people with psychiatric comorbidity is this idea that tobacco itself has significant interactions with some psychiatric medication based on interaction at 1A2. Tobacco is a 1A2 inducer, so it influences metabolism of everything else that goes through 1A2. Which includes the tricyclic, several antipsychotics, and caffeine. The most clinically relevant are probably clozapine, olanzapine. Caffeine is actually clinically relevant. And also fluvoxamine, which is not on this list, but Luvox also is a 1A2 metabolite. So the idea, again, is that tobacco is inducing 1A2, so if you're on one of these medications, you're having a lower serum level of this medication just because you're a smoker. It's seeming like the medication is not as effective. Therefore, what happens is that you tend to get dosed at a higher level. And then what can happen, the converse can also happen, which is then you're maintained on a higher level, and then if you're an individual who wants to try to quit smoking, you can develop toxicity, where now the level is too high. Medications tend to be well tolerated, so that may explain why we don't always see this in the clinical setting. But there are case reports of clozapine toxicity causing seizure. And the precipitating factor was that there was a shift in the person's blood level of clozapine due to stopping and starting smoking. Remember, this effect has nothing to do with nicotine. Nicotine itself is not metabolized at 1-8-2. It goes through a completely different enzyme, 2-8-6, where there's virtually no clinically significant medication interactions. So nicotine replacement has no drug-drug interactions. This is an effect from tobacco. And so it's interesting to think about how this may impact patients also post-discharge or, again, in this context of stopping and starting smoking. It's interesting to think about, patients who are stabilized in the hospital, which is a non-smoking environment, and then seem to relapse immediately after discharge, and the effect that smoking could be having in the residential setting on now changing the drug level of medication. Something we have not always been paying a lot of attention to. We're not talking as much today about counseling, but counseling is also a first-line treatment, and really the ideal treatment plan for any tobacco user is medication plus counseling. And so this is just kind of an overall composite slide to show success rates when people try to quit smoking at a year after the time they try to quit using various outcomes. So in general, the more intense the treatment, the better the outcome. And combinations of medications plus counseling in general have better outcomes even compared to medication alone. Just to give the sense that even though we're not talking a lot about medication today, more is certainly better, and we are going to have to think about a kind of a fairly intensive, although long-term, treatment approach for working with this population. Luckily, lots of providers can contribute to the overall treatment plan, and everybody's contribution can be cumulative. And we also have a model for thinking about tobacco that we can fall back upon, which is the co-occurring model, because we have thought about how to treat other addictions in mental health settings, and I think this becomes a very useful paradigm for thinking about tobacco, that we should think about providing services that are matched to people's motivational level. So that means that not everybody goes to smoking cessation group, but that if clients are not motivated, we're providing them with assessment, a long-term treatment approach, and motivational interventions, maybe with pharmacology, to kind of move them along and provide really a spectrum of services for different kinds of clients. It's interesting that case management and housing are highly successful aspects of a dual diagnosis, dual disorder treatment, and we could think about those also supporting a tobacco dependence treatment approach. I think it's also important just to think about expectations and be realistic. People recover even from the best co-occurring programs at fairly low rates of success, and yet we all buy into this is still worth doing, that addiction treatment is valuable because you never know when people are going to get better. It's always better than doing nothing. And I think we have to have that same kind of buy-in that this is a valuable use of our time and service and valuable for our clients, even if we don't see a tremendous amount of success in terms of counting the number of quitters that we're able to impact. So I think having a longer-term treatment perspective is also useful as you begin to think about setting up services. And certainly integrating it into the overall treatment plan would be the ideal goal, thinking about how patients can access these different aspects of services within your program or with maybe in the use of some provider. I think it's ideal for the services to be provided at the home-based program or agency whenever possible, and that agencies really think about developing services that can best meet the needs of their clients. There's different tools that are available. I'm sure you'll be hearing more about this. There's trainings that are now available beyond the one today to learn about some more specifics of assessment and toolkits and treatment planning techniques. And just briefly to say that the evidence-based counseling approaches for tobacco are things that most behavioral health counselors already know how to do. Their cognitive behavioral approaches, skill building, relapse prevention. There's no new tobacco institute that you have to go to learn tobacco counseling. You probably have many of the skills already that are part of evidence-based counseling for tobacco. Again, another reason that it makes sense for the primary agency to lead this kind of treatment. So just to conclude our presentation, and again, there's been many questions, and we're going to have fun trying to sort through them and give you our best answers at them, but it's the smoke that kills. There's tremendous opportunities for mental health professionals to be more involved in treatment. We didn't talk a lot today about policy, but policy really supports treatment, and we should be really encouraging clients to engage in tobacco dependence treatment much more aggressively and supporting their efforts.
So thank you, Dr. Williams. Before we turn this back over for a brief statements from our tobacco cessation centers partners, I would like to say to you that we're gonna open this up for questions that you can ask online. That we'll give you directions on how you can do that. But first, I'd like to tell you that for those of you that are thinking this has raised more questions than it's answered, I do want you to know that we have access to everybody in New York State that works within a licensed OMH service or even not. There are many of you, or probably all of you, are familiar with the Focus on Integrated Treatment, or the FIT modules that are developed by the Center for Practice Innovation here at Columbia University. That are our partners. They have worked with OMH in developing those modules that are driven to teach providers around the provision of integrated dual diagnosis treatment or co-occurring disorders treatment. We have three modules that are specifically addressed toward tobacco dependence treatment for people with serious mental illness. There are newest additions to the Focus on Integrated Treatment. The three modules address counseling and assessment. The second module addresses pharmacology and medication, and that module has a more advanced track within it for prescribers, and there is CME credits for prescribers who take that module. And the third module addresses how changes in the environment of care and the culture of care can drive and support tobacco dependence treatment. That's Dr. Williams was just referring to that as well. So those three modules will take you to another level of understanding about how to integrate. In particular, there'll be more details around the pharmacology in those modules. I would encourage you to sign up for them. They're free. So I will now turn this back over to Pat Bax from the New York State Quit Line, and then we will open this up for questions from people out there in the audience.
Thank you, Dr. Miller, and thank you for the wonderful presentation. Thank you, Dr. Williams, for your educational and enlightening presentation as well. On behalf of the New York State Smokers Quit Line, I want to extend a warm welcome to our new and our returning participants. We have many new participants joining us today. It's very exciting to have you join us. And we look forward to your continued participation in our educational programming. Before I tell you a little bit about the Quit Line services, I do want to mention that the slides are posted as a PDF on the upper left corner of the web page at nysmokefree.com, where you did find the call information and the webinar information for today. We do also archive the call recordings on the same page within about 8 to 10 days. And I encourage you to look also at the previous calls, because we've covered quite a few different topics related to tobacco control. Both the call recordings and the PowerPoints are available for your use. If you are not familiar with the New York State Smokers Quit Line, we are a free and confidential program. We are evidence-based, and we're available to everyone throughout New York State. And if anyone is looking to quit tobacco use, tobacco users can call the Quit Line directly. They can register for nicotine replacement therapy in the form of patches online, or they can also be referred by a provider. We do offer free coaching, motivational coaching, nicotine replacement patches, a 2-week starter kit. And also, if someone is not successful the first time, they are eligible for another course of treatment. After 3 months, they can get another 2-week starter kit within a year. We offer motivational support and extensive resources that you can find on our website, an online smoke-free community, social media, and our QR code messaging. So please take time to explore our site at nysmokefree.com for more helpful and ready-to-use tools, such as our referral program and downloadable materials and our fact sheets, especially those on chronic disease. In addition to our individual provider referral program, we do offer a policy-driven, a system-wide program for clinic sites and hospitals. It's called Opt2Quit. So if you are interested in learning more about our referral program, or if your agency might be looking at adopting Opt2Quit at your facility, please contact us directly at 1-866-697-8487. And during the busy holiday season, the idea of quitting tobacco use may not be a priority for tobacco users. However, as we do move closer to January 1st, and it will be here before we know it, I'm sure, but becoming and staying tobacco-free are New Year's resolutions for many New York State residents who use tobacco. So remember the quit line. The quit line is available to help you with your cessation needs for your patients and your clients, including the free coaching, patches, materials, the online smoke-free community, tips, suggestions, and so much more. So please contact us at 1-866-NY-QUITS. That's 1-866-697-8487 for help. We again want to thank you for your participation in today's webinar and for all your assistance in helping your tobacco-using patients to become and stay tobacco-free. We wish you all the best this holiday season. And at this time, Rachel, we will open it up for questions.
Certainly. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. If at any point your question has been answered, you may press 7 again to disable your request. If you are using a speakerphone, we ask that while posing your question, you pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. Please hold while we wait for the first question.
While we're waiting for that question, this is Greg Miller. I'll just draw everybody's attention. If you're looking on the chat section, Nancy Covell, who works at the Center for Practice Innovation, did put a message up to you showing you how you can link into the Focus on Integrated Treatment website where you can sign up to be to access all of those modules, including the 3 tobacco dependence modules. We have had some. If there's not a question lined up yet, there are a couple of questions that we can continue to talk about that came in while we were talking, and you'll let us know, Rachel, when there's a question lined up.
Yes, I was just going to say that we do have a question from Marta Hazen. Marta, please state your question.
Yes, hi, how are you? I'm a nurse at South Beach Psychiatric Center, and I usually do, like, groups and smoking cessation. And one of your topics, you did say that scheduled dose of nicotine is better than giving PRNs. And also, how much is too much of nicotine in one system?
Okay, I can take a crack at that. The in terms of how much nicotine is too much, if you think about what people get from cigarettes, they can get 1 to 3 milligrams of nicotine in their body from each cigarette. So it can vary a lot from person to person, but you're talking 20 to 60 milligrams of nicotine per day in a pack a day smoker, and now compare that to the patch that has 21 milligrams. So the patch is enough for some people, but not all people that smoke a pack a day. And so if you think of just the relative dosing of the different medications, we said that, the oral forms, the gum and the lozenge, might only give 1 milligram of nicotine for every dose. So I certainly know of lots of hospitals where the treatment when you come into the psychiatric hospital is something like up to 8 pieces of nicotine gum a day. And you could imagine that's not even enough nicotine for a half a pack-a-day smoker. So the paradigms that we used to use were probably too low. You know, it's hard to say what the exact amount should be, and I understand that in hospital settings there are nursing issues and limits to what people can do, but sometimes there can be things set up so that availability is increased. So, for example, a lozenge could be offered every 4 hours to try and increase the utilization. So I don't have an exact answer for you, just that we should try and address some of the barriers that may have previously existed.
My concern, though, is that I have patients who are, like, 6 times a day nicotine and at the same time still smoking.
I hear that concern. But before we address that concern specifically, I believe that even in those hospitals where there's been a recognition of the need for adequate NRT, so even if you think about an inpatient setting, so we're not talking about outpatient now, we're talking about inpatient.
Yes, where, patients are inpatient.
Right, where if somebody orders that you can get a nicotine gum 4 milligrams every 2 hours around the clock, or let's say they even say every 1 hour, can you imagine what would happen on an inpatient unit if 25 patients lined up every hour at the nursing station to get a piece of nicotine gum? There's no way that even if you write the order to provide adequate enough nicotine that it's going to get out to patients unless you think about some different ways. Now, I think that and where I have worked clinically, this works. You need to think about a reasonable combination. So if you offer the patch to everyone and then use the gum or the lozenge as a breakthrough craving medication, then you are giving a standing NRT order with PRN for breakthrough. I think that's one way to conceptualize it, and it's a completely reasonable way to do it. Another thing to consider is that you actually give several doses at once. Now, several hospitals have done this. They'll give up to 4 pieces of gum, even more, to last over a 4 to 6 hour period of time. Some hospitals I know of have said they'll give you a shift's worth of nicotine gum. So that's a, again, 4 to 6 pieces of gum. If you are more conservative or you're concerned about exchange between patients, you have to sort of sit down with medical staff in the hospital and make appropriate policies. But ordering nicotine gum every hour and expecting patients to go up and get it every hour is not practical. It's not going to happen, whether or not you believe it's okay or not. So I think it's important to really integrate reality into the picture. Now, I hear another question that came from you around what happens if somebody's got the patch and they're getting gum and they go out and they smoke. Is that your concern?
Yes, that's one of my concerns.
Okay, I'm going to let Dr. Williams tackle that.
Yeah, but not only that too, because some of them are not on the patch. They do want to stop smoking. They're on this, they're on the lozenges, and at the same time they're smoking.
Okay, so you're asking, is there the potential for someone to seriously overdose in ways that it
that's my concern.
Harmful to their health if they are getting nicotine replacement and they smoke on top of it?
Yes.
I think the evidence of that is that, of that being a serious danger are weak. But I will ask Dr. Williams as an expert to comment about it.
All right, thank you.
That's correct. There's actually very little risk that's going to happen in that scenario where someone's using a piece of nicotine gum and then, you know, 2 hours later they had a cigarette. I mean, there's really very little risk. Even with concurrent use, again, because the dose is small, if you think about each of these doses just as a cigarette, you could say, well, if the person would have had an extra cigarette, would something have happened to them? So there's really not that much nicotine that you should be concerned about toxicity. If someone is really not cooperating with the treatment plan or is so resistant to the plan that, you know, there becomes some real safety concern, then I think the immediate acting would be the best option as opposed to the skin delivery with the patch. and you could just provide the NRT in the evening, say, when the person wasn't able to go outside. So I think you could develop a kind of treatment planning around what makes sense in individual scenarios, but in general, there's not a lot to fear.
Okay.
So I there is a question that came up on the Internet that is, I think, worth addressing and is somewhat related. And the question is, if a client only wants to use the nicotine patch but smokes 3 packs a day and the 21-milligram patch is not enough, and they're requesting to use 2 patches, how safe is it to do so?
Oh, my favorite question. So there actually have been what we call high-dose patch research studies where people are provided with multiple patches. There's two different questions here. I guess the short answer to the question is that technically, yes, you could provide somebody with 2 patches if they were an extremely heavy smoker. The reason we don't do a lot of multiple patching is because multiple patches have not been shown in research studies to be superior to treatments with single patch, surprisingly. We might think that it's always going to be better, and research studies have not shown that to be the case. So there's a little bit of ambivalence about giving multiple patches. In some parts of the country, however, at the Mayo Clinic, if you got treatment in Minnesota, lots of patients there received 2 and even 3 patches. That's something that's commonly done there. We tend to do more of a patch plus an immediate acting. I think it gives you greater sensitivity in titrating the best dose. But if you're saying it's the patient preference, then I wouldn't rule it out that you could provide patient with 2 patches, although I think it would be fairly unusual.
Okay, that's an interesting question. So are there any other questions lined up at this point?
We do have a question from Cecilia Binkler. Cecilia, please state your question.
Yes, I wanted to know, between adding the nicotine replacement therapy and, like, the Chantix, is that something that's acceptable, the patches and the pills?
That's a great question. So even though I'm a big proponent of combination treatment, the one combination I wouldn't want you to do is to add varenicline to nicotine treatment. We don't give those in combination. Remember, varenicline, Chantix, seems to be very effective alone, but also more importantly, it affects part of the brain where nicotine would affect. And so if you gave someone nicotine medicine in addition to varenicline, it's not clear there would be a true benefit because of varenicline's effect on the nicotine receptor. So there's a chance that the person could actually have more side effects from Chantix if they use it with nicotine, and no clear evidence that it would benefit them. So the one combination I would want you to stay away from is Chantix in combination with nicotine replacement. That's not a good idea.
Right, so Chantix is sort of, it's a partial agonist. Is that correct, Dr. Williams?
Yeah, we didn't really discuss its mechanism of action, but it affects directly the nicotine receptor in the brain. So the idea is that if you use nicotine medication in combination with that, you would have no additive benefit because the receptor's already been activated by varenicline.
Mm-hmm. Is that the same for all its medication?
So for example, bupropion and NRT can be used well together, and using the same reasoning that Dr. Williams just said, bupropion obviously has another mechanism of action. It is an antidepressant, more likely than not a norepinephrine uptake inhibitor, although that's not clearly established. But it has been associated with a decreased desire and decreased craving for cigarettes in a certain percentage of people that use it. And there is no reason that if you're using bupropion that you could not use that along with NRT. So that combination would be appropriate. But we're saying that in particular, because varenicline is a nicotine receptor active medication, a partial agonist, that to use nicotine along with it is not an appropriate combination.
Okay.
Okay?
All righty. Thank you.
Are there any other questions lined up?
It appears there are no other questions in the queue, but again, if you do have a question, please press the number 7.
We have another minute or two. I'm scanning on the questions that have come in writing. Oh, yes, there are always questions about e-cigarettes. There's one here. Dr. Williams will address that as well. I will tell you, everybody probably knows this, that e-cigarettes are not seen as an appropriate mechanism for smoking dependence or smoking cessation tools. They are not FDA approved. They are manufactured in ways that the components of e-cigarettes are inconsistently known, and there's no clear indication of how much nicotine is in them. I will say that, that aside, that whenever I speak to consumers, and the question that came in seems to imply this as well, a lot of recipients and people that are in treatment for serious mental illness say that e-cigarettes have been extremely helpful to them, helping them not to smoke. It's not clear to me that it's helped them to stop smoking and stop using nicotine altogether, but I have had several anecdotal questions or reports to me that e-cigarettes have been substituted for cigarettes. It seems to me that's how they're largely being used out there. But they are not seen as an appropriate tool for a tobacco cessation treatment approach. Dr. Williams, would you like to speak to that?
Certainly, I echo what Dr. Miller said. They're not proven safe. They're not proven effective. If people are just using them as some kind of a substitute behavior, then I would strongly encourage that person to use nicotine inhaler or other nicotine replacement products which are FDA approved and known to be safe. Imagine if everybody had great access to nicotine inhaler. Maybe there would be no market for e-cigarettes. Keep in mind the tobacco companies, as cigarette sales are going down, they're purchasing e-cigarettes. So, they really are a product of the tobacco industry, not a medicinal, and we have to remind people of that. They're not tested, and their safety is not yet known.
That goes for those oral, what are those oral tobacco forms called? Starts with an S. I can't remember.
Snus,
yeah. A lot of people are using those. I would see it as a cross-addiction, a substitute dependence. Any other questions out there?
We do have a question from Dolores Adams. Dolores, please state your question.
Yes, I'm curious as to what the success rate is of using any of these methods and if you have any information on how long someone was able to remain smoke-free after using one of the methods that we discussed.
I'm going to say a few words first, but Dr. Williams can probably speak to that far more specifically than I. I do think it's important to realize that as many times as you need to repeat treatment, and even if you try to help somebody with medication, particularly NRT, for a long period of time, while trying to help them to quit smoking, you're also delivering a significant amount of the nicotine to them in a way that's not anywhere near as dangerous as it is when they smoke it. So even if trials are ineffective at creating a definitive quit rate, and even if it turns out that you're actually reducing harm more than you're actually creating a quit, you're still engaging with people in a way that they are getting less danger from the mechanism through which they are getting nicotine. So it's worthwhile trying to help them to quit with these medications, even if there are frequent relapses. That's my opinion. So
absolutely, that's true. You know, when we look at the success rates with these medications, usually people reference fairly short-term outcomes, like how do people do 12 weeks using the treatment and trying to quit. So at 12 weeks, 25 to 30% of people who use nicotine replacement or bupropion will quit smoking. So that's 1 out of 3 to 1 out of 4 people will succeed with one of these treatments. Now that might not seem very high to you, but that's not very different from outcomes from other addictions and other chronic diseases, which have very similar outcomes. The outcome for Chantix or varenicline is probably a little higher than that. It's almost 1 in 2 would quit smoking at 12 weeks with varenicline. It's about 45%. But remember, all of those numbers that I just gave you are for the general population. There's indicators that in the seriously mentally ill population, they're going to be less than that. Most of the studies have been done in schizophrenia where they're about half of that seen. So if the success rate with the patch is 25% in the general population, we see rates of 12 to 13% in smokers with schizophrenia, so about half. It doesn't mean that they can't succeed. It means that people will probably need to make more quit attempts over their lifetime to succeed, so we need to help people when they relapse to try again. So those are the best numbers that I can give you.
Okay. Can I add a second part to this question?
Okay.
Yes.
And then this will need to be our last question since we've gone over a little bit, and I want to ask someone to tell everyone how to access the slides, too. So let's hear the second part of this question.
I know that this population, they seem to not be loyal to a brand as the general population. And I was wondering, and I know that has something to do with monetary concerns that other type of tobaccos are maybe cheaper, but I also was wondering if that also spoke to the addiction to certain rituals or certain habit forming as opposed to just the physical addiction of tobacco. And if that is so, what implication does that mean in terms of another type of treatment in addition to the medication?
Well, let me say you're very insightful that you noticed that. And, in fact, we did a study that showed that patients were not very brand loyal and they are driven largely by financial concerns. So you're exactly right. But when people switch kind of from one tobacco to another, there's not a lot of evidence it changes their overall addiction. So, yeah, this population probably does use cheaper tobacco, bulk tobacco, roll-your-own tobacco, but that probably doesn't change a lot of the aspects of their illness and their addiction. Tobacco is tobacco, and it's not clear that it means that they have more or less kind of behavioral component or need in terms of their addiction either. So I'm not sure that makes a whole lot of difference, although it's a very interesting observation.
And it is clear in New York State that on average people that are on SSI are spending and who smoke are spending upwards of a third of their SSI benefit on their cigarettes. Mm. So one advantage to our patients who are living on SSI benefits is that they'll have a lot more money if they are able to quit smoking.
Yes.
So with that, I think we need to move. A lot of questions have come up around how to access the slides. Can someone let everybody know?
I will. This is Ann Wendland. I will answer that question.
Okay.
If you go to this screen that you see on the in the webinar right now is the front page of the New York State Smokers Quit Line. Just below that, the news feed, you'll see the statement about today's call, and typically that will just restate the next call. If it's not today's, it's reported there. There's a link. You can click on that link, and that takes you to the call page on the New York State Smokers Quit Line. You will see I've circled where the presentation is under the call resources, and also the evaluation is in there as well, just below the presentation. Click on each of those, the first one, the presentation, the second one, the evaluation, so that you can get your continuing education credits.
All right, and so, and if there's another presentation up there, they can still access previous or older presentations, correct?
Yes, they can. If you look down below, I have it a little covered up, but under tools, the first link is previous calls, and all of the calls that have been conducted over the past years are recorded and are posted under the tools section.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Miller and Dr. Williams. I just want to remind everybody our next collaborative conference call will be on January 9th. The start time for that call is also 12 p.m. Dr. Gary Giovino, the Director of Graduate Studies and Co-Director of the MPH Concentration in Community Health and Health Behavior at the University of Buffalo, will discuss if the 20th century was a cigarette century, what would the 21st century be? That's a very intriguing topic, I believe. On behalf of the New York State Department of Health Tobacco Control Program, the Cessation Centers, and the Smokers Quit Line, I want to express our appreciation for the excellent presentation today and thank all that participated in today's call. This will bring us to the end of our call. I hope you have a great rest of your day. Thank you, and the presenters can stay on.